You're listening to Arsenal Pass, a flesh and blood podcast for players by players, and all about strategy, leveling up, and the latest news in the world of Wraith. Welcome to Arsenal Pass.
Hello everyone, welcome back to episode 157 of Arsenal Pass. Hayden Dow here with Brendan Patrick. As always, this is episode 3 years plus one, Brendan. How are you feeling?
I feel sick because I am sick. I don't know, I have a little bit of a cold right now, just in my throat and stuff. So that's a bummer, but it's all good. I have to say, there's only one Flesh and Blood event since the inception that I've been jealous that I didn't get to go to. That's the Calling Phuket.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Hell yeah. I mean, some of it's personal because I went back and forth to Thailand for like 6 years in my youth when I was a spry young boy. But no, I'm very familiar with the area, and I would have loved to go down there and be able to see some of my old friends. And it's just a beautiful place. Like, Phuket is an awesome place. So I am. Yeah, it's like the only event in Flesh and Blood. I'm like, damn, I missed out.
Nah, I feel like you missed out on the Calling Queenstown as well. And you're about to miss out on the Calling Tokyo as well.
Yeah, I'm going to Worlds. See, I feel like you got to pick one or the other. Not if you live in APAC, so I understand. But for me, I definitely got to pick one or the other. So I'm happy to pick Worlds. But yeah, Calling Queenstown, definitely missed out. You're right. I forgot about that one. I've repressed that memory.
it makes a change when all the events aren't, like, you know, in North America. So
yeah.
I'm happy to have some choices and events to go to. And that's kind of what this year's been for APAC a little bit. Like, there is actually some choices and events to go to. Obviously, like you say, Calling Phuket just happened. Tokyo World Premiere and Calling coming out very soon. So yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of, I mean, there's like Calling Portland, right? Which is like, I'm actually jealous I'm not gonna get to that one. I'm not foreseeing being able to get that one. It's around my birthday, so who knows, Brennan. But that's the end of the year after Worlds, but I don't think so. And then there's, I think, Chicago. So like, there's still a bunch of Callings in North America to happen. One day Canada's gonna get a Calling. It's actually insane that Canada hasn't had a Calling yet. Like, I actually feel bad for Canada. It's crazy. I mean, Portland is basically Canada though, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few areas that are basically Canada. Like, a lot of those northern Callings are not that far of a flight or even a drive for a lot of the Canadians. So, I mean,
nah, it just kind of sucks. That's all. They don't get that opportunity, same opportunity.
Yeah, maybe one day. Maybe one day if they start putting up performances. Just kidding.
Yeah, they need to top four more pro tours. Come on, Joel. Episode 157, we're going to talk about getting your sideboard right for ProQuest. This is we're heading into a fairly diverse meta, right? Well, all things saying, we're going to be heading into a diverse meta. We've been in a fairly diverse meta already, and that's without, you know, LL of Dromai impending in week one of ProQuest. So kind of putting forward this idea that a strategic sideboard is pretty important in this meta, and maybe more so than ever before. I think if I thought about Flesh and Blood in previous iterations, my view on deck building and kind of prepping for events has always been about prep your AD, deck build for your AD. I kind of have a bit of a different view on that at the moment with how open and wide this meta is, and also we'll talk about it, but just some of the cards that have seen printed, where I think you can start to treat your 80 cards a little bit more like your 60 plus 15 or somewhere around there anyway, which we'll get into.
Yeah, that was my experience talking to both Matt Dilks and Joel Retta for their respective deck techs that are coming out. Well, I mean, we'll talk about like silver bullet cards and things like that. There weren't a lot of those. A lot of these cards were pretty flexible, and you know, when they paired into specific strategies, things like fatigue, I mean, they were just playing what they call fat deck, right? They just play every single card in the deck. So they don't have these silver bullet cards, only do one thing in one matchup. At least they didn't need them right now. And that's for respectively Kasai and Kaeya, which I guess are just fundamentally powerful and flexible decks. But you know, we're not seeing something like, which we might even talk about, like a Time Skippers or something for Prism.
Well, that's exactly what I want to talk about. Like, I think it's interesting that you kind of say like that on that side, because I feel like at the moment I feel like I'm on the opposite side, where you have access to these cards that can be super flexible and you may or may not want to play in certain matchups. And so yeah, I guess we'll get into both sides of it. But you know, we're going to talk about Time Skips. We're going to talk about Waste of Spite. We're going to talk about Spell Void as well, Brian. Your favorite topic.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Both these decks had Spell Void too. Spell Void as well. So, yeah, I think it's a correct choice, especially going into the post Dromai meta. I think Spell Void is a very cheap way to get a massive amount of equity against what will be one of the more popular decks in the ProQuest season.
Yeah, just want to shout out a few things in terms of videos and things going up. So by the time this pod drops, there will be a deck tech up with Brennan talking to Matt Dilks, calling winner from Pro Tour LA on his Kasai deck. Great, I think. And also a video that just went up is top five decks for ProQuest Season 5. And I put Kasai at number one, Brennan, just a little bit of a spoiler there. I think Kasai is the deck I'm looking to play for ProQuest. I think it's super powerful post-Dromai. I don't think the Dromai matchup was particularly great for Kasai, but I think actually what you get after Dromai hits LL is you get access to a lot more card spaces. I'm sure you talked about it with yeah. Dilks, right? Like you had
most
to play all these
of the
poppers.
Spaces were devoted to Dromai. I felt like for both decks too, like they had significant board space devoted to Dromai. Let me ask you a question, since you said Kasai is your number one deck for a ProQuest. Why not Dorinthea specifically? Dorinthea coming off a very impressive performance at the Pro Tour. Why what's shying you away from Dorinthea and what's pushing you towards Kasai?
You must be reading the YouTube comments.
I got that question
in after posting the video. But also, to be fair, I did put Dorinthea in that top five. I think Dorinthea is good. I think one of the things, there's anecdotal evidence and then there's kind of like testing data and things like that. Hatchet's Dory, which is what we saw perform well at the Pro Tour, interestingly, I think actually not very powerful or very favored into Dromai. I don't think it's a very good matchup for Hatchet's Dory, but we still saw two Hatchet's decks have success at the PT, right? And, for whatever reason that was, I think Dawnblade was actually the better option into the PT, or at least a hybrid sideboard, right? Of like Dawnblade plus Hatchet's, whatever. And so I do actually think Dory gets a bit of a bump after Dromai goes, interestingly. But what I think is that I think just Kasai just has a more powerful hero ability when you're playing single-handed weapons, and I think has a better game plan. So I think one of the issues for Kasai in this previous format and why it's maybe probably around Dorinthea, or even probably Dorinthea was probably better actually heading into the PT, was that you had to devote all these spaces to Dromai cards, right? Poppers effectively. And what you couldn't have was your hero ability as Kasai is really powerful, right? You banish the cards, you push over the top with gold, and gold is like what you can get, the value you can get out of single gold in Kasai is kind of insane, right? With Raise an Army or with a Blood on a Hands turn where you draw off the gold and get to swing all your weapons for free on that Blood on the Hands turn. So you can do it off really low resources. So the more you can cut these poppers and you can add in attack reactions to push your hero ability over the top. So anytime you activate Kasai, you guarantee, or you effectively get close to guaranteeing that you're going to create that gold. The equity is huge. All the copper in case of Blood on the Hands with turns like Spoils of War, sorry. And that's versus Dory with the Hatchets playing a card like Spill Blood. So effectively, basically what I think is that Kasai just gets a massive bump and Dory only gets a slight bump. And that's why I think Kasai is kind of the better warrior post-Dromai.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually listened, in addition to reading some of those comments, I listened back to our podcast with Sam O'Byrne, or at least I randomly clicked the timestamp. I realized that my prediction for the Pro Tour was KO, Dromai, and then I said Kasai, but it could be Dorinthea. It's just interesting, the dichotomy between Dorinthea and Kasai specifically, yep. Because I know in our testing group, at least internally, and of course, this is with the caveat that Nick did play Dorinthea at the Pro Tour and he was in the group. I felt like our group sort of landed on Kasai as potentially the more preferable warrior for a tournament like the PT.
I think a lot of that was time spent on Kasai and kind of the input, and probably kind of similar. Yeah, the fact that the Hatchet's Dory just felt really inferior as a plan into Dromai. And I think what Nick landed on was Nick played pure Dawnblade, and I think his plan into Dromai was really strong. It was similar to something that Dagon White played. And I think, you know, maybe you gave up equity against Guardian, but ultimately Guardian didn't really show up, right? So, or didn't do well.
Shout out Team Blue Pitch.
Yeah, look, I mean, Team Blue Pitch still put up results playing probably a deck that was not the strongest choice. So, Xing did anyway. I think Xing top 32. All right. I guess lastly, yeah, Colleen Paquette happened over the weekend. I managed to catch some of the coverage. The kind of story was the Prism going undefeated in Swiss, rolling into top four and then meeting a determined Brody Spurlock in semifinals and Brody ultimately taking the Colleen Paquette. So congratulations to Brody, the world globetrotter that is Brody Spurlock, wreaking havoc now in Asia. So congrats to the winner on Azalea there if you didn't catch it. Super diverse top eight if you didn't see the event. I think there was 7 different heroes represented. I think there was two Prisms, actually. So kind of the story of the weekend, I guess, a little bit was Prism. And then obviously the second story with Brody, but also other Azalea winning the Battle Hardened as well. So I guess, you know, Prism and Azalea. And we actually have a question about Prism, which we'll get to in the Commander Cookout. So
someone posted a meme on Twitter about ALS being banned as a result of the loop being displayed on the coverage. And I will tell you, it 100% got me.
Like, yeah, Brendan sent it to me. He's like, this has just happened.
The way they wrote it, it sounded exactly like Brian. Like, I never thought somebody could emulate more Brian speak than that. So it 100% got me. I was like, oh, that makes sense. ALS, okay, it's banned. This is great for Kano. And I went through the whole mental gymnastics, and then I realized that it was fake. So good job on whoever created that.
I think the giveaway, Brendan, was them saying, I've gone away and read cards. We know Brian doesn't read cards. That's just lore at this point.
Someone also told me that, speaking of not reading cards, that Codex of Frailty is like almost $100 or something right now, which is like a random, not very Arsenal Pass S tidbit. But yeah, they said that like the foils were like over 100, I think. And then like, they're like $85, like something crazy. And I was just like, what?
Oh. Do you want to start Market Watch? We could do Arsenal Pass Market Watch.
Mm-hmm. God, I was trying to think about some play on words I could do for Staxwell, because Staxwell does all the market watch. But yeah, maybe that's the transition. Maybe Staxwell, that's the future of AP. Well, you just start.
Maybe I need to watch. What's the Staxwell? Staxwell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I'll check it out. I'll tell you what. Here's my strategy. I just get the cards at release, and then that's what they're worth.
My strategy is buy a bunch of Monarch, go 98% down, and then just, I have conviction in the product. I'm holding, you know, I just believe in the product.
Tales of Aria 2?
No. I was out by then.
All right, let's get into some other news. I want to talk Part of the Misfail. We've had a lot of, I guess basically what we've learned in the last week since we recorded last time, Brendan, basically in the classic fashion, after we hopped off the pod last time, we got a lot of information about how Transcend and Chi works. So if you haven't already seen this, I want to talk through this a little bit. So if you haven't seen these Transcend cards, we'll have a look at one to start with. I'm going to pick one that has readable text, because some of these cards
that is so funny. That is 100% exactly what I was thinking. I have the cards pulled up in Fabry. It's like, I legit cannot read these cards. They are unreadable.
Okay, I'm going to put this on record to start with. I don't like the look of the set so far.
Okay,
it's just not my thing. It's just not my thing. Like these alt arts. Look, yeah, like I get it. I get the thing. I'm sure they're cool to some people. I really don't like them. Okay. I find them hard to read. The colors like kind of blend with the words.
Devil's advocate. I love it. Yeah. I think they look great. I think they look fantastic.
I knew you would.
But some of this is definitely fan service, which is okay, but like, I don't know. It's an interesting pivot for them, because they're definitely leaning into some of like, I don't know, the more anime-esque stuff. And that's not all of them. It's just, I think it's actually like the promo, for the upcoming, Tokyo thing. That one, I was like, okay, this is a bit of a stretch, but I love this stuff. I'm 100% like in the far, kind of like the far end of make them look cool. Make them look like whatever you want. I don't care if they look consistent or not. Because I know in like Magic, that bothers a lot of people. Absolutely does not bother me.
I love massively annoy me in Magic.
Yeah, I love that people can like customize their decks in like specific ways. With alt arts are my favorite for sure.
Yeah,
there's one with a cat on here. Like stir the pot.
I was about to say stir the pot. There's like a Studio Ghibli kind of thing happening here with this. But I'm going to read the one that is not the alt art that we can see on February. This is Preserved Tradition. Mm-hmm. So this is a Mystic Instant. It's a legendary, but it's a common. So the type is legendary. You may only play one Preserved Tradition in your constructed deck, but it is just a common. It says, put target action card from your graveyard on the bottom of your deck. If you've played another blue this turn, Transcend. And the reminder text for Transcend, which is when we learned about this, which is, it says, put this into its owner's hand flipped. So when you Transcend, you transcend Preserved Tradition, you put it into your hand, and it turns into Inner Chi, which is a Mystic Resource Chi, and it says the Chi symbol, which is now what we know to be the Chi symbol, can pay for either Chi effects or Chi costs, or it can pay for normal resource costs. That's the card, basically. So all the Transcend cards on the flip side, I believe, are going to say that. are going to have that, and we'll have that same reminder text. So when you transcend, you flip the card, you get your chi resource on the back, and your chi resource can then be pitched to, now we know, activate hero abilities like, you know, Zen, for instance, or New, or Enigma. First thoughts?
Honestly, it's kind of elusive to me. Like, I don't immediately see the play patterns, and like it's not that I don't understand it. It's just like, how is that going to play out? How is it going to feel?
It's not, because this will go back into your deck, right? Because you'll pitch it, you'll transcend, you'll pitch it, you'll pay for your new Alluring Desire or whatever, and it'll go into your deck, and it'll be flipped.
Yeah, on the chi side. Which is interesting. So yeah, it's not. It just, I can't really at this point of reading these cards, I can't really evoke the feeling of what it's going to be like to have these cards in my deck. But is it? Do I like the concept? I think so. It's wildly new, right? Like, it's a completely new way to play Flesh and Blood. I think from a fundamentals perspective, I don't like flipping cards in sleeves. That's just something I've never really enjoyed in TCGs. I like the design of flip cards. I like two sides of cards, but I don't like pulling out a sleeve, putting it back in. But I think it's pretty cool. I mean, who would have seen this coming? This is way better than, hey, we have another 3 for 7, like some shit like that. I think it's pretty novel and new, so I like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, I'm not personally, like, I'm not, I know there's some people who are really big fans, like flipping cards, for instance, right? I've never been a big fan of double-sided cards just in any game, but I think this concept is really cool. You know, obviously, you basically, yeah, you're the card is transcending, it's transforming, and then it's going to, because of the way that, you know, in other games, basically, or even with the dragons, right? You flip your dragons, and then the dragons, and they die. But some, the cool thing about Flesh and Blood, obviously, is this kind of living deck, you know, and generally, it's kind of like, well, you play your reds, and you pitch your blues, and your deck gets weaker. But all of a sudden, you know, with this set, actually, potentially, your deck gets stronger, right? You know, the whole Flesh and Blood thing from the very start has been start full, kind of end empty in the scrap, right? Whereas now, actually, and there's always pitch stacking and things like that, right? And ways to get cards back. But this has a very fixed mechanic on kind of powering up potentially second cycle opportunities, specifically through Transcend. So, yeah, I think it's interesting. I think I'm most looking forward to the impact in Limited, I think. I'm a little bit worried about, you know, what happens when someone forgets to flip their card back after the game, or it's unclear, they've shuffled the deck and it's unclear if that card ever got transcended, or some rules questions and some judge calls that might result from this. But, you know, that's the thing that can be resolved with just clarity and maybe some rules clarification.
For me, I'm just happy we're breaking the mold. Because I feel like Flesh and Blood, in my opinion, Flesh and Blood design is pretty strict. Because it's so balanced off of that algorithm. It's like kind of hard to figure out like new ways to interact with the game system. And I almost think that the basic design of the game is almost like it heavily limits like what you can do. So it makes me happy that they've both found ways and are willing to implement ways for you to engage with Flesh and Blood in a new manner, because that's, it's not immediately clear. If you're like, hey, if you asked me a few months ago, like, hey, how do we design interesting Flesh and Blood cards? And by interesting, I mean not 3 for 7s. I'd been like, I would have had to have a serious think, and I probably wouldn't have come up with this. So I'm happy that we get something totally new.
Yeah, so let's take a look at just kind of trying to evaluate some of these cards and what it means in like a game kind of perspective. So if we take Stir the Pot, your new favorite card, Brennan. So Stir the Pot is a 0-cost legendary, well... Yeah, okay. This is going to be so confusing. It has the legendary type. It's a 0-cost mystic instant. It's legendary, so you may only have one Stir the Pot in your constructed deck. It says shuffle. If you've played another blue card this turn, transcend. So you have to have played another card, for a blue card, in order to transcend. So you have to play a card that's potentially blow rate, right? Because we know blues are generally blow rate. You don't want to be playing blues necessarily. The effect on this is shuffle your deck. So how do you put a value on shuffling your deck? It's kind of hard, right? It's kind of contextual a little bit. Generally, shuffling would have basically close to zero value, I would say, in the game generally. But you might be able to, that might change with a set. This costs 0, but it costs you a card. So it basically is a full card to shuffle. But if you've played another blue card, which is potentially already below rate, what you're going to do is you're going to immediately transcend into chi, and you get the resources back into your hand. So effectively, if you've already played another card, a blue card, you're going to get this back into your hand as a blue resource card for free, right? And then also have it as chi and already be able to activate an ability. So say there's something like your hero ability, for instance. Maybe for, in this instance, let's take Zen. So Zen, if you are familiar with Zen, is once per turn instant, chi, so three chi resource. Create a crashing tiger in your hand, search your deck for a card with combo, banish it, then shuffle. You may play it this turn. So for instance, I played another blue card first, and then I played my Stir the Pot, shuffle my deck, I flip into chi, and then I activate Zen. What kind of value am I getting off that? Well, again, that's contextual because it depends on the value of the crouching tiger, but I do get to go and search for a card with combo, banish it, and play it this turn. So I've at least turned my blue, that blue, into a combo card, the combo card I need, plus a crouching tiger. So I'd say it's probably, you know, it's like up on value of that blue card, of that chi card, but I've had to play a blue first. So maybe somewhere around even, but then I also get the chi in my deck. So the value is super complicated, I think. It's really hard to understand exactly what the value of these cards may be on face level, you know, kind of valuation, effectively, on how we kind of look at this these cards.
Yeah, good. It's like the least interesting thing about Flesh and Blood is sometimes the value, the value of a card is printed on the bottom left, you know? I like that it's convoluted. What do you think about all these cards being legendary so far?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know why. I guess thematically I can understand why to a degree, because you can have just one copy of the chi, so it'll turn into the chi. So we know that Preserve Tradition, for instance, turns into inner chi, but we don't know what the other names are. Are they all inner chi? Don't know, because on inner chi it says this transforms from Preserve Tradition. So I assume these are gonna have different names. That way you can understand the card. But I don't know. I don't know if they necessarily needed to be legendary. I guess we'll find out. Some of these effects might be super powerful. Again, it's really hard to tell. There's a lot of like graveyard hate in this set as well, which is interesting. So you have just new in general as a hero ability, but then you have Passover, which is banished target card from opposing hero's graveyard. If you've played another blue, this turn it transcends. So yeah, we'll see.
It's convoluted and complicated right now, which is a good thing. I think ultimately the art is evocative, the heroes look cool, and the design is novel. It is unique. It is very different from anything we've seen in the past, so that all gets a big thumbs up for me.
Yeah, also, well, just to say, when I say graveyard hate, I mean, obviously, if you've read new, it is partly for new, definitely, because new says, look at the top, so pay the chi cost, look at the top card opposing hero's deck. If it's blue, you may banish it. But then it's a full stop between new's next text line, which says, until end of turn, you may play blue cards from the hero's banish zone without paying their resource cost. So you don't have to banish the card, the blue card you're going to play this turn, off of that new ability. You could have banished it off, you know, some of these cards that that have graveyard hate. Or, for instance, new also has this ability that says, your attacks with stealth get, when this chain link resolves, banish all action cards defending this way. So you banish a blue card, you know, the blue Macho Grande you just banish from your guardian opponent. Then you activate new at some point and you banish a red. You see a red, that's fine, but until end of turn you can still play blue cards because you pay for that ability. So I don't know, new's really interesting, honestly. I'm kind of a little hyped on new.
Interesting. I also think new's very cool. Playing your opponent's cards is cool.
Yeah,
I'm interested to see how it'll play out, if it's like an actually powerful deck, you know, if people are siding out some of those more powerful blues, like if they're no longer included in the list because they're liabilities. But that would be a good thing, right? That would be a metagame, like a metagame adjustment to, and like a very reasonable one at that. You don't add in the Macho Grandes or the Terra Sunders into your deck because new is the best deck in the format.
I think the other cards I just wanted to briefly mention is these cycle of effective blues that turn into reds, kind of. And what I mean by this is I'll read them. So we've seen Droplet, which is a mystic action attack at common. It defends, it costs, yeah, zero cost. It's blue, defends for two, attacks for two, and says if you played another blue card this turn, it gets plus two. So effectively, if you've played another blue card, it turns into the rate of a red card. I like that. I think that's quite interesting to basically have the value printed of a blue, interact with other blues to turn into almost a red at face value. So you've got these at 0, 1, 2, and 3. So for instance, Tidal Surge is a 3-cost blue mystic action attack that attacks with two and defends. Sorry, attacks with 5 and defends for 2 and says if you've played another blue card this turn, it gets plus 2. So you get to turn into a 2-card 7 if you've played another blue this turn.
Can we talk about the tragedy of not having a mystic wizard in the set?
No.
Let me point to a card. Orion. or Ori on of Mystic Tenets, 4 cost, Mystic Instant at Majestic. Right. Is a legendary. It says draw 2 cards. If she was pitched to play this, instead draw 3 cards. Well. That would be a fun card in Kano, but it is not. My local group chat was just like, they were collectively memeing about, you know, not having a Mystic Wizard, because this is just like the exact card you would want. Probably be too powerful, but yeah.
You just play it with Enigma. It's fine.
Honestly, a lot of these heroes might play like Wizard, to be fair. They look super interesting. So
Enigma might, yeah, honestly. Yeah. This seems to come out of Cookout. Honestly, part of the misfile, very interesting. I'm keen. I'm actually really keen for Limited in this format. It looks like it's going to be not value-based, which makes me really interested in what it might look like. So, hey, look, I know, I'm just throwing it out there now. We shall see. I am planning to be heading to the world premiere, so I'm going to get excited about that. Come on, a Cookout. First of all, get your questions in. We've got a couple of great questions that kind of came in over the past week, but we still have space over the next month or two for other questions. So if you want to get your questions in, please do. We love questions that are kind of out of left field, a little bit different, make us think, maybe some things that you've been thinking about, but just haven't been able to find people to have a conversation with you about Flesh and Blood. We'd like to hear those. Speaking of which, we've got Man with Brisk from Discord asking, Brendan has been pretty dismissive of Prism due to the Brute matchup, but KO is the most popular deck in Phuket, and 2 Prism decks made top 8. Has he reconsidered his thoughts about where she stands? Is it really just a matter of there being very few strong Prism players to practice against?
My evaluation of Prism was in context of the PT when looking to pick a deck, and those were our results. Have I reconsidered? I mean, there's pretty much no opinion I hold on any hero or any matchup in Flesh and Blood that I would not be immediately willing to throw out the window if there was different data. And if you are not like that, I mean, you're just a dumbass. So, like, I don't know. Like, it's just weird. I think that people, like, look at some of our, like, whether it's our testing data or our opinions on heroes and how we come to decisions to pick decks for tournaments, which is based off a subjective evaluation of what is a small sample size of data, and they assume that we have like an ego rooted in that opinion, and like it's just not the case. Like Prism in our testing did not do well, and is that as a result of the of what people say on Twitter, which is like they're just, you simply were playing against the good Prisms? Is that a result of that? Potentially. I would just have to play against a good Prism to figure that out. That's simply just how things go. I know it's not as interesting as being like, no, I would never change my opinion. Prism sucks. But like, no, it was just like, we tested it for the Pro Tour. It didn't seem to have a good matchup into KO. And yeah, we ultimately decided to not choose the deck. Haven't revisited any opinion of the deck since then. I did see its power displayed at the calling in Phuket, though. It looked fun. I like locking people out, so I'm intrigued.
Of course you do. I'm intrigued. I think what's a really good point there is, I just want to highlight what you said, Brendan, which is, you know, when data's presented, you're in no way, shape, or form married to a thought of a matchup or a deck's performance. And I think sometimes people think that you talk in absolutes, you know, in terms of that, and like you have these views. But Brendan is actually probably one of the most of the people I know in terms of that I've tested with or worked with, ready to like, you know, jump to understanding a new perspective of a matchup potentially, honestly, like with when data is presented. So what I would say, you know, because people can always say the flip side. You said, oh, you haven't played against good Prisms. Well, you can also say the flip side, have you played against good KOs, right? And that, like, people can always present either side of the argument. What I will say based on this is that from our testing, I agree with Brendan. I think Prism was actually looking pretty strong, to be honest, but the KO matchup looked not good. And I would say Prism was winning that matchup a little bit until the KO players understood what the Prism deck was doing. And then it just looked like a bloodbath a lot of the time, honestly. It looked pretty one-sided a lot of the time is what I would say, actually. But I would say overall KO was kind of just cooking the Prisms after a while. So, you know, I didn't see any KO versus Prism matchups over the weekend. Obviously, the Prism player is a very good player and was playing very well over the weekend, the one that we saw on camera multiple times. But I didn't see them get to play into, like, I was really hoping to see the Prism player Chu Heng, who I know you're aware of, Brendan, one of my favorite players from Singapore, was playing KO. I was super keen to see Chu Heng play into into Vespa and see that matchup, because I think Chewing might, you know, Chewing's a famous prison player. I think Chewing might have understood that matchup better. So,
yeah, I always the one in particular that always gets labeled on me, which is just like not a position I hold at all. And I guess it's like almost memeified at this point, is that I think that Bravo is like a fundamentally bad hero in Flesh and Blood, which is just absolutely not the case. I thought that Bravo was worse than Old Tim. And if you didn't think that, okay, you're probably in the wrong, to be honest. Let's be real. If we look at data, you're probably in the wrong. And then also, I think that Victor has a lot more potential than Bravo. Not that it's better in every single metagame, but I like Victor as a Guardian more than Bravo. And people like, be like, I want an armory with Bravo. How the fuck could you say that? And I'm like, what? Like, what does that have to do with anything? And you can escalate armory to Road to Nationals, calling, whatever. It doesn't mean Bravo's bad. It's just I've liked the other ones a little bit more. It's just weird. It happens all the time. It's like, people think I hate Bravo. I've registered Bravo at so many fucking events. It's actually crazy.
Dude, you've done it like twice. Calm down.
No, it's at least three, to be honest. When I went back through, I registered a Road to Nationals, a PTI event, and then there was one other that came to mind. That's like my second or third most registered.
I only know the Road to Nationals and PTI, and in my defense, both those times you told me you're gonna play Bravo, I said do not play Bravo. One time I said play Old Tim, and the other time I said play Leviah.
Yeah, the Old Tim advice was probably pretty good. It was pretty good advice, but nevertheless, I got a soft spot for the boy.
Hey, the Leviah advice was good too. Leviah was the second best deck in that format. I don't know what you're talking about.
All right, on to the main topic.
I want to talk a little bit about this idea of sideboarding in Flesh and Blood. I think basically my hypothesis, right, Brendan, is that we've moved from a time where you talk about your 80 cards. You look at your 80 cards. Every time I've deck built or I've looked at matchup plans, probably prior to, right, actually, honestly, almost all the way up to heavy hitters, I've basically always looked at it as 80 cards. You know, it's like, here's my 80 cards, or here's, and maybe in the early days a little bit differently because I was adjusting from Magic, but I would say the majority of my Flesh and Blood career has been like 80 cards, and this is how I want to use them. This is how I'm building out my 80 cards. This is what they look like in different matchups. And yes, I'm obviously citing cards out, but it was always like, these are cards coming out of my 80. And I think now there might be another school of thought, which is like, here's a 60 card main deck. Here's what my plan looks like. And not to say we haven't had this before, because you've had like super linear decks where it's like, here's my combo 60, or here's my like aggressive 60, and then there's my sideboard for certain matchups. But I think even the mid-range decks want to do that now. Like, here's my core 60 and here's my 15 cards. And the reason I think that is, there's a few things. I think there's more silver bullets than we've ever had before for matchups, where cards do overrate of what any other card might do in that particular matchup. Because I think previously you walk into a matchup and it's like, okay, I can have like 6 to 9 cards for this matchup, and they kind of help me build out that matchup. I think a great example is I build my pop account against Dromai, for instance, or against Prism to have more impactful cards against that. Another example is like, I add in 6 to 9 defense reactions to give myself the opportunity to value trade or have it stop big turns from Warrior, for instance. But now I think you have more silver bullet cards effectively. So I think about cards like Time Skippers, you know, in the Prism matchup right now. I think about Spell Void against Kano specifically. I think about Oasis Respite against Kano specifically. I think about there's a lot of cards against Kano, Brendan, and I know you're aware of this. I think about, you know, kind of having unmovable, particularly against Azalea, to stop like a key turn that might value out at higher damage, as opposed to just defense reactions as a flat example. I also think that multiple game plans can pay off in this meta. So you might think of like a Switch sideboard, traditionally something like Dash. You know, I'm a Dash items plan versus a Dash boost plan. And I think that is there. But I think even more heroes can do that before. So I think Katsu has that ability. I think you could play an aggressive 60 card combo Katsu with like a defensive package in your sideboard. You could play Azuri with a similar kind of thing. I think Guardian has that ability right now, where Guardian's like, okay, I'm a defensive deck, and then I plug in basically these go again cards from my sideboard of my 15 cards for matchups where I want to be aggressive. So it's almost like a modal sideboard. I think the power of like trading linear aggressive plans versus defensive plans has more merit than it ever has before, because I think there's a lot of the power level overall, I think, is a little bit lower And then redundancy of cards looks a bit more similar, but you can move in cards that have modal aspects. So like a Sync Blow, right, is a one mode. It does one thing, right? And Red Snatch does one thing. Like it, yeah, you whatever, you can block for two, but it does one thing. It attacks for four. And I think we've had metas previously, we've had such power level that these cards kind of were only okay. But honestly, these cards are so powerful right now. And I think the modality of cards and what you can do with your sideboard, I just think we haven't been in this meta before. So all that to say, the last thing, which I think I know is something you talked about with like Dilks as well in the deck tech, is this idea of just like adding extra cards versus fatigue, just as options, just more redundancy of cards. So basically, that's why I think right now there's this kind of shift, or this can be this shift of like looking at a 60 and a 15 card sideboard more than ever before.
Mm. So I've never been an 80 card gamer. This is not like, what's funny is that both these things are kind of the same thing. It's just a way of approaching it. Yes, they're a little bit different, but I've been more on the 60 plus 15 school of thought. That being said, I would usually do something more like a
50, like Kano, bro.
Well, not like, but that's the thing, is I would usually do something like a 52 card core, plus cards that come in and out based off the matchup. So the 52 card core, 50x card core, could be 47 or something like that. It's just like whatever cards never come out of your deck, they're core. And then the other ones fill in your deck, depending on the matchup. Your core could change, but it would be an outlier. Let's say it's the next set and you're playing against new and you have Terra Sunder and Macho Grande and you have these extra blues that you could add in for free out of your sideboard. It's like, okay, your core might change, but ultimately it never changes. That is what your deck is trying to do every single game. And then you just kind of add in cards based off the matchup. That's how I've always approached it. And yeah, I guess honestly, what's funny is you mentioned that Kano is actually the outlier. Kano is, I have 60 cards, and then I have this pile of cardboard that sits in my deck box that I never utilize.
yeah. Basically, you have 62 cards because there's a three bear tunic is your 61st card, and then your 62nd card.
Did we ever tell the story of Threadbare Tunic at the Pro Tour? Of the night. A little bit of a tangent. So as we were sitting in Hayden's room, and he was, you know, he was
listening to the loud Spanish music.
Graciously put on some music for us for that night. It was getting a little late, but you know, he likes to blast music. And I was like getting my last few cards from my Kano deck. I need to borrow some from Hayden. Hayden gives me a Threadbare Tunic, and I'm like looking at the card and I'm like, you have to like do some different sequencing with this, don't you? And it's like, yeah, there's like this, you do it in this sequence. I'm like, what do you think are the chances that, like, what do you think the EV is between me fucking this up versus me just playing Spellfire Cloak? It was like, oh, Spellfire Cloak, higher EV. And I was like,
I don't even think I said anything. I think I just pulled the Spellfire Cloak out.
I was like, oh, Spellfire Cloak, put that in there. I'm just going to do that. yeah, so I just didn't play Threadbare because I was like, I can't be bothered to potentially mess this up. Anyway.
So that was going to be my joke, was 62 cards, 61st is Threadbare Tunic, 62nd is Spellfire Cloak. But yeah, that was a 60 plus 15. I want to say the idea of the 80 card gamer, right, I actually think is the same as the 52 card gamer. Like, I think they're the same philosophy, just different approaches. Like, here's my 52 card core and like 8 cards are different every time. And so effectively it's like 52 plus 23, right? Yeah, because five base equipment, or 52 plus either 28 or 23, depending on how you look at your equipment as well. But for most people, it'd be the same equipment every matchup. But I think the 60 plus 15 is a little bit different in that you're shifting like specific cards for non-specific cards. So like your sideboard of 15 cards are very specific cards for specific matchups, which we're going to talk a little bit about what those cards might be in this meta. But then you're taking out cards that are not necessarily specific for matchups. So for instance, like if I said like Guardian previously, it's like, okay, I have like my Zealous Beltings in my sideboard, and I'm only going to play them against XYZ matchup. And so they're part of my 23 plus 52. And then they take the place of like a defense reaction potentially in a matchup, right? Whereas I think when I look at something like Victor, for instance, like your 60 is really kind of set because you want to have a certain number of attacks to win your clashes. But when your clashes don't matter, then effectively you're like, okay, I can trim down on that a little bit. But those, the cards you're taking out, the attack actions you're taking out aren't necessarily specific cards like they were if you were playing Ultimate and you're like, okay, I specifically want either defense reactions or I want these going in attack actions. So I just think there's like, and the reason I want to point this out is because I think when we talk about the 15 cards in your sideboard, I think you need to be really, really clear on like why a card is in your sideboard right now, as opposed to previously it's like, oh, okay, well, it's just a plug and play piece to my 52 cards that I play for a group of matchups. My argument is that instead of having like 23 cards and like a chunk, like a segment of each of those 23 cards go into chunks of matchups, mm-hmm. I think my point right now is that you should probably, especially if you're playing mid-range, you should probably just have a really set 60, that's the most powerful 60 you can have, and then have cards for specific matchups as opposed to, yeah, like chunks of plug-and-play components.
How does that relate to like fat decking and fatigue though? Does it?
Well, I think because if I fat deck into fatigue, for instance, so I can use my example from the PT. So I played Dromo, right? And I'd say like I kind of had this to a degree, like I kind of had a 60 cards that I thought was just like the best 60 for Dromo to be playing. It probably more honestly might've looked like 57 cards, to be honest. But I know there were some players. So for instance, like Kadavra's Contraband was being played by so many people main deck at the PT in Dromo. Whereas previously that would have been like a cyborg card and you've been like 52 plus your 23, like you're saying. But basically very close to like 60 cards a set. And then if I played against fatigue, so warriors in particular, I thought would try and fatigue me. Yeah, I mean, I was effectively like just plugging in my, like adding my fatigue cards from my sideboard and going up in extra cards. Like that's basically what it looked like. Like as opposed to being like, you know, I have maybe just play 60 cards. So previously in like fatigue in Dromai, I'd probably play like 60 cards, but I would just play like multiple remembrances and stuff. Whereas this time I was like, well, okay, I'm just going to bring in my block threes. I'm going to bring in my remembrances, which are specific for this matchup and fat deck. So I guess fat decking is like slightly different, but it's still kind of the same approach of like, I want the same 60 cards. I'm just bringing in extra cards.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. It's just something I noticed, like I mentioned when we were going through the deck techs, that like a lot of these cards, well, they did have use cases against something like Dromai, like specifically, whether they're extra poppers or they, you know, efficiently clear some sort of dragon. It's just like, okay, if we pair into a fatigue matchup, like let's say it was a Guardian Trident Fatigue, all these cards can actually just be played as attacks if they need to help us get more reach. Yeah.
Yeah. I think as Dromai goes, I think this idea of the 15 card sideboard is like easier to execute because you kind of had to have like, honestly, a lot of your like extra cards devoted to poppers if your matchup into Dromai was bad. And I just don't think that's the case anymore moving forward, right? So maybe you're a deck that has naturally some poppers, like your answer to Prism and the ALS loop might be time skippers, right? If you're a deck that like has, I don't think you need as many poppers for Prism as you do against Dromai, for instance. So maybe you still do have a six cards that come in against Prism specifically, and then there may be five pops and a time skippers, for instance. So I want to talk, and basically the reason I think this is, I guess, changing now and why we're seeing this is, again, yeah, just going back to the fact that just cards are so, I think there's also been a lot of cards printed that just very similar, honestly. Like if I take Brute, for example, you just got three more CNCs with Send Packing, you know. If I take Brute, for example, you just got some better go again cards that do the same thing as before, but just in different iterations. If you look at Warrior, for instance, same thing. You have all these access to redundant go agains that you've never had before. So I think just like it's so much easier to just have 60 cards with cards that do basically the same thing, and you can round out a really strong 60 and then have this specific game plan. And your game plan might just be value. Like if I take Kasai, for instance, I think, you know, your game plan is still value, but your 60 is like the best way to be a value deck. And that's kind of just what it is.
Makes sense.
Let's talk about some sideboard options for ProQuest. So if I'm set there and I'm like, okay, I built out my
pre-Dromai or post-Dromai?
Let's talk post-Dromai.
Okay.
Screw Dromai. Let's talk post-Dromai. I'm set there. I'm looking at my 60 cards that I've set out with. I'm playing KO, I'm playing Kasai, I'm playing Dory, I'm playing Riptide, whatever I'm playing. And then I'm looking at my sideboard options. I think let's start with equipment. Spell Void, Brennan?
I think that it is inversely related to Prism. Popularity of Prism, more Prism there is, less Spell Void in play. And the less Prism there is, the more Spell Void in play. Honestly, post Phuket, I think the Prism is going to gatekeep Kano in the ProQuest season to a great extent. And I honestly, I think, in my opinion, Spell Void is overkill, usually to the percentage of Kanes that will actually be at the tournament. That being said, it is an extremely effective tool for turning that hero off. Like, it is by far the most effective thing you can do. It's more effective than putting blues in your deck. It's more effective than adding additional AB. It's just super, super powerful. So if you want to beat Kano and you think that there is a reasonable percentage that will show up to justify putting that Spell Void in your deck, then I think it's a great tool for that. Yeah, that being said, in my opinion, whether it is equipment or it's the additional 15 cards that you have in your sideboard, I believe that every sideboard slot should be fighting for its life. Unless you're playing Kano. Unless you are playing Kano. Like, if there's ever a situation where you think with a reasonable sort of you have a reasonable expectation there will be 0-1 Kanos at a tournament and you're devoting three slots, it's like, it would be hard to find a deck that would not get a percentage of equity from swapping those few slots to other tools you could use in more popular matchups. So I think it's very meta dependent, but yeah, in regards to equipment, if you want to be Kano and if you think it's worth it, because even if you end up losing to the one Kano of the tournament and there is just one and it's like a 50, that just happens sometimes. That's okay. You may not be worth it to have three cards in your sideboard slot. So it's an effective tool. It's an effective tool if you need it.
I think that actually brings like a really good way to look at how to approach the 60 plus 15, which is that if you look at your 15 card sideboard, they should really represent probably what your matchup spread expected to be is. So let's say your 60 has a good matchup into the second most played deck. It's like, I don't really need to change any cards. Maybe you still want to have a couple of cards devoted in your sideboard slot to that. But if that's the case, then the number one most played deck should probably take up the most sideboard slots, potentially. The number three down after that, number four, etc., all the way down to, okay, like Brennan says, expect one Kano this time, maybe no Spell Void. But if I expect Kano to be like top five most played deck, maybe I'm going to play like SV2, AB2, for instance, or SV3, AB2, whatever. Other equipment I want to talk about, obviously, Time Skippers is kind of the hot one right now, yeah, with just kind of the power of Prism and the run of Prism in the weekend. Do you think it's worth a spot?
I was going to ask you the same thing. Do you think it's necessary? Do you think that, one, do you think it's effective enough in every deck that it could go into, right? Because it's very costly. Do you think it's effective enough? Do you think it's needed? What's like the meta representation of Prism that you can even include that card in your deck? Because there's not, like, you have to go deeper than, is Prism going to show up? Because it's not binary, is Prism going to show up? If yes, therefore Time Skippers. Also, can my deck utilize this card? What does it lose as a result of playing this card? What boots am I swapping out? And then two is like, is it even effective? Like, is this card even
effective?
Are
they going to go for the ALS against me, or are they just going to go Heralds against me?
Yeah.
Or
and they have to work for the ALS lock, so once they see you flip Time Skippers, it's not like a free roll like it used to be in the old Prism, where they're still going to be, old Prism kind of used to free roll ALS a bit, so you would pretty much always get use case out of your Time Skippers, especially if you were playing Starvo, this is like the last time Prism was relevant. But yeah, Starvo kind of free rolled those boots.
I think it's contextual, right? I think you've just kind of nailed it. Like, do I think it's correct to play it? Do I think it's worth a spot? I think it's a little bit meta context. First of all, actually, the context is it a good card for me in the matchup? Is it going to be impactful in the matchup for me? Or like you say, is it just, they're not going to care about it? It's not going to be effective in my deck.
Is it going to help you win, or is it just going to help you not lose faster?
Exactly. So for instance, in Dromai, like, I was pretty close to playing a Time Skips at the PT because I thought Prism was pretty good, but ultimately I thought people just wouldn't land on Prism. People were coming off of it pretty quickly. There was a week where we were testing it. I heard other people were testing it, but I came off pretty quickly. I think Evan was maybe the last of the group who was like, oh, maybe I play a Time Skippers, but no one played Time Skippers in our Dromai group. But going forward, yeah, I think it's definitely a card with a lot of potential. The other card, if you're not playing Time Skippers, and this is going away from equipment a little bit, could be the Time Snap Potion. Maybe your leg piece is too important, but you can afford to play Time Snap Potion, for instance. Some other pieces of equipment I think that fit into like a 15 card build of sideboard right now, I think Balance of Justice is a really interesting card right now. I think if you're, is it a card you can afford to play against KO? It does have a lot of equity against KO if you're expecting them to be on a Blood Rush Bellows Pan, or that card's going to have a lot of impact against you. It's also good against other other decks as well. So, for instance, if you're expecting Dash to be really reliant on high octane turns against you, it's super powerful into the best turn they can have, which is Spark of Genius into high octane, or the other way around, high octane Spark of Genius. There's also obviously other cards that are out there. Drawing. I've seen this, like, I don't know if you've seen this, like, Balance of Justice, like, Kano deck people are playing, but...
No.
Yeah.
No. What does it do? Like,
They're just basically trying to have a combo where they can have an extra card with Balance of Justice.
It kind of makes sense. Like, you actually, if you... They may not be playing Potion of Deja Vu, but whether you're playing Potion of Deja Vu or you're pitch stacking, like, Ragamuffin's Hat is only needed if you're first cycle comboing without a Potion of Deja Vu. So, like, for instance... when I was at the PT and in the constructor rounds I played after, I think I cracked my Ragamuffin's Hat 40-30% of the time, like under 50%. But I landed Deja Vu's like almost every game.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, and that's probably meta. That's a meta context, right? Kano is so hard to play meta contextual, honestly. Okay, other ones I want to talk about, Hardened Crossstrap. So, you know, am I getting the value out of my Tunic, or am I playing a Hardened Crossstrap in this matchup for whatever reason? I think it's really interesting right now. We've seen beaten trackers from the KO side. I basically think that you can probably play more equipment than you ever have before, because equipment is both powerful just naturally, and also there's more equipment that can do specific things into your set 60. So a lot of the time before, previously, it was like, well, I play this equipment for this plan, and how my deck operates. Whereas now, honestly, you can, like, I think you can plug and play stuff. Or, you know, I play Null Rune because my opponent's doing stuff.
Yeah.
So I actually think equipment is, like, super interesting. Yeah. Obviously, it's
theoretically the best sideboard card. Like, it's the best sideboard, like, value prop ever, because it starts in play, stays in play. Like, that's the thing about sideboard cards. It's like, you have to draw them, you have to draw them at the right times. Like, now with the current editions of equipment that exist that do hose certain heroes, things like Spellvoid, or it could be Balance of Justice, it just starts in play, stays in play, so you're guaranteed to get the value off it. It's like the best sideboard kind of cards that you can have.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's so many pieces of equipment in this game now as well. I don't know if there must be over, like, 150 or something. There's so many. Silver Bullet options. We talked about at the kind of top of the topic, Oasis Respite. You know, obviously that's kind of been a very famous one and a bit of a meme of, like, how many Oasis Respite are you playing in this Kano meta, whatever it might be. But, you know, I just talked about Time Snap Potion for Prism, for instance. I think, you know, I don't know if you played this, but Imperial Ledger, did you play that at the PT?
No. That's for... Yeah, I didn't play it, but... I would maybe play. So the thing is, I honestly didn't have the information on the card at the time. By the way, Hayden's referring to, like, a card that was in Kano sideboards. I think it was for Dash. It was also for the mirror, I think, to, like, blow up items. I don't even know. Basically, I didn't have the info, so I was like, whatever, it's probably not going to matter anyway. It didn't, but yeah. Maybe I'll play it.
Oh, they were playing... I thought they were playing the one where you name a card and then you don't get to...
I think they're playing that one. Yeah, they might have been playing that one too. I don't know if they're playing something that blew up items or if they're playing that one.
Yeah, I thought they're playing Imperial Ledger, which is... oh, no, Imperial Ledger is the shuffle. And create a...
They were playing token. Something. Something that dilutes the combo, so... Yeah.
I need to go back and have a look. That's Imperial Edict, sorry. That's the one I meant. Yeah, name a card. The name card can't be played until the start of the next turn. That's the one I thought. That they were, I mean, pretty exact. I know they're playing now, so whether that was to stop imposing combos or Oasis Respite or whatever.
Oasis Respite, I think, specifically.
Yeah, makes sense. Pitch stack, other Silver Bullet cards, I think. And when I say Silver Bullet, I mean also just cards that have, if you're going to draw them at some point in the game, are going to have more value than the average card in your deck, which is because, again, going back to cards like the. How homogenous some cards are now and how similar they are. I just think you can get away with more of these types of cards. So is there anything from, like, an enhancement standpoint, do you think, where it's like, I put this card in my deck in a certain matchup and it enhances my game plan? I was thinking, like, Hardened Crossstrap is one of those, but there were people talking about, I can't remember the name of the card now. It's just completely blanked.
Okay, sideboard cards is that enhance your game plan. So like the first ones that come to mind are ones that were Shadow and Lighthosers back in the day, where it's like, if okay, here is a six attack popper you could have in your deck, or like a six attack you could play out, but it's like, okay, if you're here, if your opposing hero is also light, then you get this additional effect. But I think that just falls into the above raid kind of stuff, to be honest. So like enhances game plan doesn't come to mind immediately.
I think just on Silver Bullets, going back, sorry, briefly, the other one I forgot to mention was Ripple Away. I think that's a card we've seen a little bit more recently. You know, I think it's a, obviously that might just fit into 60 because it's a resource card, but potentially if you want extra blues or you have plug and play pieces where you can be like shifting blues out for a certain matchup, I think Ripple Away is an interesting one. Being able to deny that agility token against KO can be really powerful.
Down but not out.
Also, it's really good against Kasai to deny a Raise an Army token as well.
Yeah.
When you can't go wide enough. So
I really like Down But Not Out as well as a sideboard card.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it's like a super powerful sideboard card. I remember they were on like much higher copies on the KO deck, but it can be very polarizing in KO if played at the correct time. Like, yeah, I mean, you're talking about a matchup like a true, you talk about a true mirror that can be very back and forth, and one player gets value of Down But Not Out. It just feels very unfair.
It's interesting because I think Joel, before his top 8 match against Seb, so obviously they opened Deckless, but also Seb kind of knew why the Down But Not Out was there, because he'd been in the testing group. Joel was like, game time decision on whether I play it or not, with obviously Seb knowing about it. So do you think now that people know about
it? I talked to him about it, so he said that it was like worse than a regular 6 attack, I think, in his deck.
Yep. Yeah. That's pretty bad. It was funny, when I was watching them test, I was like, oh, you're going to play the Down But Not Out. And I, oh, game time decision. I was like, oh, I feel like I wouldn't play that card. But I thought the card was, I don't know. I think once the card's known, I think it's kind of whatever. I think that's why one copy is like probably the correct amount, honestly.
Yeah, that's like
once they see it.
It's like a historical TCG dynamic where you face an opponent, they know something in your deck. It requires them to play in a certain way, so you side it out of your deck. I mean, there's extremes of this in Magic where people basically side out the win conditions of their combo. So when they get to the combo, they demonstrate a loop, but they don't demonstrate the win condition. Their opponent concedes on the spot. I don't think it happens anymore, but there's some 90s Magic tournaments where people did that. Basically, they didn't have the win con. Yeah, they had two. One specifically, I can't remember who it was. He had like two win cons in the deck or something like that. Both the same card. One of them got milled away or got taken away in a way. He starts comboing, but he's actually sided out the other one. So he only had the one of. He starts comboing, shows the pattern, opponent concedes, and he wins.
And like, opponent concedes.
I think it's like a Pro Tour, too. I can't remember. I kind of feel like it's whoever was famous for like one of the first combo decks that existed in Magic. I don't know if it was Mark Justice. I can't remember.
Maybe it sounds like a Justice thing.
Yeah.
I want to quickly talk about some other cards that I think are interesting right now. Battle You Got as a sideboard option, I think it's quite interesting. Warmonger's Diplomacy, I think it's quite interesting. Hold the Line, it's particularly quite interesting. Some of these are resource cards, right? So they might just be able to fit in your deck naturally, but I don't particularly play Hold the Line in certain matchups. It's a 2-block that kind of, you know, can be a little bit of a liability in some of those matchups. But those are cards I particularly like as well as potential kind of cards in my 15 that are going to be super impactful, I think.
Yeah, and they were printed, like a lot of this card, especially like Down But Not Out, like it's printed as a sideboard card. It's just like this gets insane. It's like insanely above rate in the right matchup.
Yep.
Yeah.
Smashing Performance. There's another card.
That's Silver Bullet right there.
Yeah. It's going to be, for a specific matchup. No Fear, I guess, to an extent is kind of that. But I think a lot of people looked at that card just for the sheer value of what that card could do.
Definitely. You know, it's a funny sideboard card. Cast Bones.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess stay tuned for the deck tech where Joel dives into why that is a sideboard card and how they utilize the card. But one of the most above rate, quantitative, if you want to take your bingo card, cards in Flesh and Blood is actually ended up being a sideboard card in the KO deck.
Interesting. Okay. Yep. I mean, we know that some people didn't even play it at the PT, right?
Yep.
So. Cool. I mean, that's kind of the main ones I wanted to hit on, I think. There's so many more examples of this, but basically I think what it comes down to is we're going to more and more, I think, see like solidified 60 cards because of just, again, how similar cards are, game plans being fairly specific, even if their value game plan is just cards being doing the thing and being having reasons to be in the deck. But then a lot of cards that can be significantly above rate in certain matchups because of their impact on the game, or because of the text that's printed on them in relevance to how it interacts with your opponent's board state. So like Smashing Performance, for instance. So that's kind of where I honestly think we're heading a little bit in this next meta, and we'll see how it shakes out of a ProQuest season. But yeah, I guess my number one kind of tip would be have a look at your deck and have a look at your sideboard or your sideboard plans at the very least, if you're not kind of on the 60 plus 15 idea, and look at like how impactful the cards in any given matchup. And I would suggest if you're playing one of these kind of more mid-range decks, you probably want to have a 16 plus 15 and have that 15 cards have the most impact it can for your meta.
What are you playing for ProQuest season?
I think I'm going to play Kasai. I think it's gonna be a K deck, you know?
You're going to play Kano, huh?
Katsu,
Kano, K.O.
K.O.
What do the new heroes have a K? No, just Zen. I don't know why I thought Zen was like, it was Ken. We can call him Ken.
Yeah, Ken. I'm playing Ken. I'm just Ken. I think, do you know what? There's one hero that's interesting to me quite a lot. It should be tangent out of this main topic. Betsy.
What?
Betsy, man.
Betsy, I saw some degenerate stuff posted in the Betsy channel during the PT testing. Well, it was something ridiculous. I can't remember. Was it some sort of combo? What was it?
I don't know. It's probably the number one Copa, though. We already know this.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. The new heroes look cool to me. That's what I like. I'm happy that... I think Heavy Hitters was a great product for Flesh and Blood, and I think that it revitalized a... like a year and a half of just dead sets, to be honest. And I thought the Heavy Hitters was a massive success. That being said, it's like not my cup of tea in terms of gameplay. So I'm super excited for Part the Misfail. Like, everything just reads like, oh, okay, this is exactly what I want to be doing in Flesh and Blood.
I have a question for you. Is blocking good in this meta?
Like in this meta? You're asking a Kano player.
Yeah, but just like holistically, do you think like defending is good in this meta? So, like, the reason I say that is because, okay, what's the top decks right now? Like, I think it's probably Kasai and KO. And I think both of them can, like, at times block fairly well. But they're both value-based decks, I think.
I don't think the KO deck's very good at blocking. Like, it has a lot of...
It can be. It has a fridge. So.
Yeah. I mean, almost every deck in the game has a fridge at this point.
But it has three blocks in the deck as well. Yeah, like, it doesn't just not have three blocks.
Yeah. Do I think that blocking is good? I don't know. It's contextual. But you're also asking a person that didn't play, opted to literally stay as far as possible away from mid-range value decks. So, like the deck that I play blocks all the time. It loves blocking because it sets up its energy potion on its own turn, and then it just wins the game in a single turn. But from the decks that I recognize as top decks, it seems like blocking is very core to those strategies. Maybe not KO, but the Warriors, like they definitely want to... From what I understand, they want to be blocking with two cards and then getting value out of the two cards in hand because they're above rate weapons and things like that.
And the reason I asked the question is I think there's like decks that I'm leaning towards. So if I think this is a meta that defending is good in versus a meta where defending is not good in, and that can be a sliding scale, right? I think as you can take it, definitely is a sliding scale. Like I think at the PT, for instance, I think it was a meta where defending was pretty good. There was a lot of mid-range decks. There was a lot of value-based decks. And I think that's why we didn't see success with something like Azalea.
Can we put a pin there? Because so do you think that defending is good against mid-range decks, like against value decks? Because from what I understand, at least from like the highest level of fundamentals is like...
No, I don't think it is.
Yeah. Mid-range decks or at least value decks, they get more value off of attack than defense because defending cards are inherently understated.
Some of them are. Sink Below is not though. Right.
It's like the only, that's like
Take It on the Chin's not, Fate for Scene's not. Like, I think basically what I'm getting to is we land on the sliding scale is if you think that defending is good, then people are going to play defensive cards in the deck. Mm-hmm. And the way to punish that is to not attack, basically, is to find ways to punish them for having those defensive cards. So, for instance, Kano is a great example of having that. I think. Tekla Vossen, I guess. Even Tekla Vossen, like Viscerai potentially. Like basically making things inefficient for your opponent, I think, is is really good. I actually think Viscerai is kind of playable right now, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Honestly.
But what I don't want to play is I don't particularly want to play Dash.io. I don't want to play Azalea. I probably don't want to play Betsy. I probably don't want to play Katsu. Like, you know what I mean? If blocking is that good.
In my humble, unbiased opinion, Kano is just the funnest deck in Flesh and Blood right now.
So. Yeah.
It is. You gotta come back around to it. It's really fun. Like, I know...
You should play some Max.
I will. Definitely, if Kano rotates or if it's like... That's absolutely a deck that I'm interested in that I have zero experience with. Like, it does look pretty cool.
Okay. I'll just close out my point. Basically, my point of asking that question and where you think the meta lands on a sliding scale of defending good, defending bad, probably indicates to me what kind of deck I want to play in this ProQuest season. And I think the reason for wanting to play Kasai is I think that defending reasonably good, not necessarily amazingly good, and I think it falls into a good space between those two things. That's it. That's where I see things right now.
That makes sense. Let me know if you land on Kano. Also, Prism.
Do you know what? So I put Prism in my top decks to play for ProQuest season, and then it went and had a really good weekend at Calling Phuket, and I think that's kind of blown out my... I wanted to play the deck because I thought it was kind of a bit unexpected and people wouldn't know how to play against it, and I think people are going to learn to play against it. A lot of people are playing on Talishar over the next week or two, so I'm probably less interested in playing Prism than I was 7 days ago when I recorded the ProQuest.
Haters will say you recorded it after Prism did well.
Well, I can share the timestamps of my recordings if they like. I recorded it on Thursday.
Fake news, don't believe it. All right. Well, if you listen to this podcast, you enjoy it, the number one thing you do is leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. There's a video version of this on YouTube, youtube.com/ArsenalPass. We do have tons of deck techs coming. So we have Kasai with Matt Dilks, KO with Joel Repta. Hayden's got the other 1-2. Shout them out. What do we got?
So the other deck I didn't talk about is Reinar. Okay. And I'm gonna share the Reinar deck tech. I think Reinar is actually in a pretty good position, but I'll explain maybe why I'm not as excited about it for ProQuest season. And then the other deck tech is TPC. We're lining something up, hopefully pretty cool on that one. Something a little bit different.
TPC is to be continued or
to be confirmed.
To be confirmed, dude, that's the most Aussie shit I've ever heard in my life.
What?
I think we do TBC. Yeah, we do TBD, I think, to be determined.
What about TBA, to be announced?
Let me just never heard of TBA in my life. But when you say TBC, I think the Burning Crusade, like a World of Warcraft expansion.
Hey, drop us down in the comments and let us know who's right.
Hey, CBK, could be keen. All right. Yeah, so all that stuff's on YouTube. DCG, check it out.
Bro.
Yeah, check it out. And thank you to all the Arsenal Pass patrons. All the deck techs have additional written pieces with cyborg guides, tips and tricks, basically how to pick up the deck and immediately start crushing with it. That's all going to be additional written pieces on Patreon written by Matt Dill, Joel Repta, Hayden Dale, and whoever the TBC is. So check it out, and we appreciate you all so much for the support. It helps us do what we do. And thank you all so much. We'll see you next week.